This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax. This is episode number 786. It is Friday, December 8th, 2023. And today, I'm very happy to welcome to the podcast some first-time guests. We'll be talking to the team behind a brand new holiday-oriented podcast called George Bailey Was Never Born. Obviously, that's a reference to It's a Wonderful Life, directed by Frank Capra. So on this episode, we're going to have, in the second segment, the team behind George Bailey Was Never Born, Ray Novoselsky, and Dave Cassidy. I should mention Dave, who is, let's say, the EP on this podcast, which is, by the way, part of the iHeart Podcast Network. He is an old friend of mine. He works for Barbara Kopple at Cabin Creek Films and has been responsible for helping to get Barbara on this podcast a number of times, helping kind of conduit for that whole process. And we'll hopefully getting Barbara back on here soon. But it's great to have Dave Cassidy on here for the first time and his partner in this podcast enterprise, Ray Novoselsky, who is the man who conceived of the podcast and gotten it executed. All 10, I think it's 10 episodes of this podcast are available currently, and you can go to iheart.com/podcasts, and you can find it very easily. Just Google George Bailey Was Never Here. I don't know why I'm explaining it to you, but that will be on the second segment. But first up here is Mark Barden, who is the man behind Sandy Hook Promise, an organization which is helping to fight gun violence, which is, of course, off the charts in this country. And it all started with, of course, Mark and his wife's losing their son, Daniel, in the Sandy Hook school shooting 10 years ago. There's a new documentary called A Father's Promise, which is about a band of musicians, if you will, who have gotten together behind Mark and his organization to prevent gun violence, which is always unnecessary and avoidable. Including in these musicians is Derek Truck, Susan Tedeschi, Jimmy Vivino, Sheryl Crow, who, by the way, is executive producer of this documentary, and other musicians. These musicians work to raise awareness and to try to pressure policymakers into helping prevent gun violence by passing policy and laws, and it's very effective. Mark himself is a professional musician. He's one of the best guitar players I'm aware of, and so tapping into all these music friends of his was not that difficult for him, and they certainly rallied, as you'll see. Oh, I should mention that the documentary of Father's Promise is currently playing at the Look Cinemas in New York City and will be on various streaming platforms imminently. So here first up is my conversation with musician, activist, Mark Barden, here on Film.
I was very happy in my role as a father and a professional musician before the tragedy that took my little Daniel from us. All three of my children, and you know, Daniel included, were very connected with my music. It was very meshed. That all changed on that moment, and I tell you what, it not only changed everything for us as a family, but it rewired me as a person.
What happened in Newtown can happen anywhere, in any instant. Any dad in America could be in my shoes.
When are we going to do something?
I've been in this building before, many times, wringing our hands, pleading with legislators, what can we do? Until we finally said, we have to go home and do this ourselves.
This only happens in this country. and nowhere else. Nowhere else do little kids go to school thinking that they might be shot that day.
Well, I'm going to get out of the way. I'm a little nervous talking about it. I'm a little intimidated just because of the, you know, the background, your background and everything that's, and I've seen your face come up on YouTube many, many times.
Oh, sorry.
No. So again, having just sort of at least expressed where I'm coming from now, I feel like I could talk to you. I was really looking forward to talking to you. So,
well, thanks, Adam. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Of course. So, and to put myself at ease, I set this here.
I see that. I noticed that. And that's why I unblurred my camera because yeah. Usual suspects in my background.
Okay. I'm just taking a look at it. I noticed during, of course, you played your Taylor acoustic a lot during the documentary. So,
yeah, that's not here. Oh, no, that's the Takamine. Taylor is, I think,
that's
upstairs.
Right. That's
sorry. it's a 414 that my cousin gave me as a gift.
Wow.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
It was a surprise, yeah.
So by way of also just transparency, I've been doing this film podcast for quite a while, for like, you know, over too long, almost embarrassingly long, talking to independent film makers, people. I always request the if I can get the subject in the film, that's great. Or and also fiction films, and I work with the Woodstock Film Festival up here. I'm in the Hudson Valley, which I know was where you guys were living before moving to Sandy Hook.
We were in Pawling, New York, actually.
Yeah. Oh, so close to Connecticut.
Yeah,
but still in New York. And
but familiar with the area. My father-in-law lives in Sullivan County in the summertime in Smallwood. And actually, I participated in another documentary called Newtown by filmmaker Kim Snyder.
I remember that.
And that was actually that was shown at the Woodstock Film Festival.
Okay. I think it's possible I even did a segment on Newtown, that the documentary, now that I'm pretty sure I did. Was there a, I don't want to get too far afield here, but was there a Cuomo in that involved in Maria?
Maria Cuomo, yeah. Cole. Cam and Maria will also be at the concert on Thursday.
Right, which is to take place in Manhattan at
Skirball Center.
Skirball Center.
Skirball Center for the Performing Arts at NYU.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah, that's a great place. Love that spot. Yeah, I had on Kim and Maria on this podcast all those years back.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah. And finally, I work full-time. My full-time gig is actually at a radio station where we play Tedeschi Trucks, where we play Sheryl Crow, where we play the Weight Band. So I this summer got to see Jimmy a few feet away in a really intimate so this was a treat on multiple levels to see A Father's Promise.
Oh, awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that. And it's a treat for me to be able to play with all those musicians that you just mentioned and more.
Well, I must say why not? There should be also feel the same way about you. You're a huge talent.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I can only imagine just as you expressed in the documentary, which I'd rather you almost describe because I've been talking nonstop since we got on here. But Father's Promise, I'll just start it. You interrupt me. So it is it's kind of achieving a number of things at once, could we say, the documentary?
Say that again.
It's achieving or attempting to achieve a few things at once, the documentary, in the sense that it is at once a bringing gun violence, the conversation around gun violence, certainly to the forefront of, and how can we as a community do something about it? And then also, it's a personal documentary about your family and about other families and healing, and how music plays a huge part in that and can play. And so music can also heal on a personal level, but also perhaps bring us together because it, of course, transcends politics.
Yeah, I mean, you captured all of it, Adam, beautifully. I think we're done. you really did.
Thursday.
I'll unpack what you how I feel that you share you really did capture it all in that when Rick first approached me about this, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago, maybe more. His initial concept was to explore the role music plays in healing after profound tragedy. And I felt that was something that maybe I was getting close to ready to talk to, because it was a process for me to kind of return to music because of the intimate connection all three of my children had with my music. It was a difficult journey back, but I could sense that there was a story to tell there. And I was on board. Over time, it has morphed into more and more, as documentaries will do, as they kind of discover themselves through the process of being created, that it, in Rick's vision, it became more focused on my story, more specifically, which, you know, I'm not going to lie, that's I've never been a spotlight guy as a musician. I always like to be the support role, serve the song, serve the songwriter, just paint textures to deliver that, whatever the music is, not necessarily never needed to be the spotlight in the front. But I feel like there is a story to tell here. And again, to another one of your points, it's about, I've always felt we have the numbers. We have, I honestly believe that there are most folks in this country want to protect our children, their children. Everyone's got to agree that we want to see our communities be safer. And what we've done at Standing Here Promise is we have identified and implemented tools that do just that without, you know, compromise anybody's rights, without being political. We do this good work, and we're getting positive outcomes. We've prevented many school shootings already by students trained in our Know the Science programs. We've prevented over 500 suicides that were imminent because students were trained in our Know the Science programs and either accessed the 24-hour crisis center or told a trusted adult who got them to the help that they need. So those are basic things that are working. We have a model that works. We don't charge anything for it. It's a no-brainer. It's a win-win. And it just comes down to what you said, is getting more support and getting more numbers. And with the Artists for Action component now mixed into this, we are able to reach a larger constituent or more varied constituencies through the fan bases of these artists. And we all know it's tried and true. When an artist is on board with something and urge their fan base to also get involved, it's a great mechanism for increasing engagement, which is exactly what we need to be doing. And you know, there are things folks can do without turning their lives upside down into being a full-time advocate. They can vote, you know, which is according to those same principles of protecting our children and making our community safer. They can volunteer their time. They can tell their networks about this. Like, as you say, has to be part of our narrative, part of our conversation. When you consider death by gunshot is the number one killer of young people 19 and under in this country, the number one, and it surpassed car accidents and everything else. It should be the number one issue, or at least one of the main issues of every American. And this is a great way to reach more folks through this coalition of artists that Artists for Action is curating. And with the work that Standing Here Promise does, which is nonpartisan or bipartisan and solution-based programs and policies working together, and it's effective.
Yeah, I'm going to put, I'll put, of course, links to the Sandy Hook Promise, to Artists for Action, and everything that I share with in terms of our conversation. And how do you, as I'm a father of a 19-year-old myself, and I and you know, my partner, she has three grown children or growing children, you know, and I'm just like, how do you keep moving forward and not get lose to rage, to being intentional about avoiding criticizing our, you know, senators and congresspeople, because I don't want to make this about that. Actually, I want to focus on the what we can do, you know. But I also wonder, as I watched the documentary, and again, it's called The Father's Promise, I wonder how you managed to keep moving forward and not get swallowed in.
Yeah, and thanks for asking that question, Adam, because it is part of my process. It's part of my life now, is being intentional and strategic about how I move forward. And it's been that way since my second life began, which was when my little Daniel life ended. And in the early days, my wife and I were just consumed with grief and despair. And there were moments where we were open about just not wanting to go on. At the same time, being able to intellectualize that we didn't have that option, because we have
two
we have a
others.
12-year-old and a 10-year-old who are actually supportive of us. I mean, they've
Amazing.
come to us and rescued us and put their arms around us and said, we're gonna make it through this.
Wow.
And it speaks to their amazing character and how lucky we are, just in general and specifically. So it's been a process of how do you go on. And the work that we do at Sandy Hook Promise is double-edged for me. And I'll just be honest, and I'll name that up front, that it's tremendously gratifying to be able to honor Daniel in such a substantive way, to do exactly what we set out to do, was to prevent other families from having to endure this life of pain due to preventable gun violence. And that's the fact of it. And we're doing that, and we're doing that at a growing scale, and we're doing that with more success all the time. And it's a privilege to be able to honor Daniel that way, and to protect James and Natalie and your 19-year-old and everyone else in that way. But it comes at a price, because I'm constantly immersed in all of the fabric of things that led to Daniel's, horrific preventable murder. So there are those things that there is despair, there's rage, there's discouragement. Every time there's another mass shooting, and there are many, it can be very discouraging and deflating. And then I just have to willfully pivot to, because of the work of the great people at Sandy Hook Promise, I'm part of something that is working. And it underscores the importance of that work. And it underscores that we need to just continue to push forward. And can't give up on honoring my little Daniel. I can't give up on protecting my kids and your kids, especially when we have a model that works. I just can't turn away from it.
It was a kind of crucial that, since music, as we already mentioned, this transcends politics, transcends other divisions, and we're in a time right now where we've never been more divided, as a strategy from some people. But to include hip hop, to include country, to include what other, am I forgetting any others? I mean, you kind of include the films in terms of the getting a coalition together, musically. It was smart to like include all genres so we can reach all people, right? And underline that this is affects everybody.
Exactly. That's exactly the idea. This affects everybody, and everybody has a stake in this, and everybody has and should have. Everybody has a voice, and they should exercise that voice.
What kind of numbers of people are you aware of, like just how many people are involved or on board with what you're doing?
I'd have to look the latest numbers up, but maybe 20 million adults and students have participated in our
It's
trainings
amazing.
across all 50 states, around 26,000 schools. Definitely now, maybe 16, but definitely 15 school shootings that were planned and imminent and had to meet a very high criteria for being established as imminent, law enforcement cooperation and access to firearms and all of that. 15 school shootings that were planned and ready to go were averted by students trained in our programs and saying something and getting that individual connected to help before it became that tragedy. And like I said, over 500 suicides that did not happen. So those kind of success metrics. And then on top of the bad things that we're preventing, or students who are trained in our programs are preventing, we're also fostering a culture of upstanders who are more connected, more compassionate, more aware of each other, more likely to communicate, and we just see that really having an impact on our culture over time and at scale.
The film is going to actually be in theaters. Well, at least I know in Manhattan. That's all I know about so far. In the Look Cinemas in New York City as of this Friday, I guess, right? The
Friday, December 8th, yeah.
8th. And do we know of any? Maybe I'll just if I find out any more, I'll also help spread the word about that. But and then I'm assuming not too far off, it'll be available on demand.
Yes, and Rick would be the one to ask for that timeline.
I figured.
I know he's sent that along. But yeah, the premiere is at Look Cinemas. I think it's on 57th on at 7 p.m.
on the west side Friday.
Yeah, and then it goes on from there, and then it'll be available on streaming platforms widely at some point after that.
Yeah, probably early 2024 is my guess.
I would guess, but again, Rick would have the timeline. Exactly.
Yeah, we'll get all that. That's fine. Yeah. Well, you mentioned before, Mark, this concert, the Skirball on Thursday. I will at least get the video version of this up and out, you know, so I can start to promote. But I'm assuming it must be sold out or something. But anyway, can you talk about what to expect on Thursday?
It's going to be a great show with so many amazing artists. And the house band is amazing all by itself, you know, and I'm just privileged to be part of that house band with, you know, every chair is a luminary in their own right. And then, you know, being able to support such incredible artists as Sheryl Crow and Peter Frampton and Bernie Williams and the Dooms and Rozzy and Jen Chapin and, on and on. It's a wonderful thing. And there'll be snippets of from the documentary, also footage
great.
That's not in the documentary that was filmed for the documentary. You'll only be able to see it there at the concert.
Well, conversely, would the concert be available to watch if you are not in New York City at some point? Do you know about that?
I have to check if it's going to be streamed or not. That's a good question, Adam. I'm not sure.
Or just even in the future, you know, like if people want to see it, because that sounds like an amazing, and it could be used, of course, as a way of again getting spreading great information and in such an amazing way, you know.
Right. And the songs will kind of be thematic there. You know, there's kind of a message built into all the songs, and Kevin Bacon is with us as well.
Right.
Performing. And I think there may be still some tickets available. I don't know the exact, but I think it's they are selling. I think I've heard that it's doing well. I'm not sure.
Well, I'm sure it is.
But there may still be tickets available if folks would like to check it out at the NYU Screwball Center for Performing Arts on Thursday, December 7th.
Well, it's been a real honor, pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for making the time with, I'm sure, what is a very, very busy schedule. Anyway, again, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. I really appreciate it. And I, you know, on a personal level, I think it's just the most important documentary that people must see. So,
thank you.
You know, of course. So thanks again.
Thanks for the time, Adam. And yeah, I think Rick did a great job. Rick and Essay did a great job of telling the story with care and thoughtful intention. And I think it is something that folks should see.
I agree. Well,
thank you.
Yeah. Thank you too. All right. Well,
hopefully we'll talk again.
I hope so too. I hope to, and maybe jam with you someday.
Love to. Sounds good. Let's do it.
All right. When exactly? Right. When exactly? No.
Kidding. You tell me. Is that a guild? Is that a guild?
Actually? It is a guild. And I bought it in, I know we have to get off, but I bought this when I was in high school still in 1980.
Oh, wow.
Like 1980 or 81.
Wow.
So this is an old friend of mine. Yeah.
My brother-in-law has a beautiful guild with such a great voice that he bought, I think, in high school. But that was maybe 20 years before yours. But yeah.
Oh, and he'll well, be don't be so that. Sure. Oh, well, you know the year. So, yeah, you would know. Yeah, this was right on Queens Boulevard.
Wow. Okay. This might have been from similar area. We should talk. I know we have to go, but we should talk about that, too. All right. Thanks again, Adam.
All right. Thanks for making that such a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Somehow, in some way, on some other plane of vibration, he knows that I'm doing my very best to honor him and that I love him and I miss him dearly.
Okay, up here next is the team behind George Bailey Was Never Born, a very successful new podcast. All 10 episodes have dropped. This is the first, possibly only season of this particular podcast, but it is a robust telling of the story and the phenomenon that is It's a Wonderful Life. Here is the man who conceived of this podcast, Ray Novoshelsky, and my friend Dave Cassidy, who's helped executive produce the podcast, right here on Film Wax.
Come be part of a one-of-a-kind podcast experience.
So it would be on 20 or 30 times, like, per day on every channel?
You watch it every year.
Realizing that this movie that had become kind of a punchline because of its omnipresence was actually really good.
It moves you every time.
My father cried. I had never seen my father cry before.
I just remember having this very warm feeling about everything about it.
George Bailey, I'll love you till the day I die.
Yes, It's a Wonderful Life is one of the most popular movies ever, but it runs much deeper than you ever thought.
If you were to ask the random person, is this a subversive movie? They're going to look at you cross-eyed. I mean, of course not.
With regard to the picture, It's a Wonderful Life, the Federal Bureau of Investigation stated in substance that the film represented a rather obvious attempt to discredit bankers.
You sit around here and you spin your little webs and you think the whole world revolves around you and your money. Well, it doesn't, Mr. Potter.
By choosing Dad to be George Bailey, Capra must have intended to convey a certain type. The movie means different things at different times, like in these troubled times in this country.
I want to welcome today's guests on to the podcast. I'm happy to bring on two women who have neither have been on my podcast, though one of them has helped coordinate one of the podcast friends, Barbara Koppel. That's Dave Cassidy, who's in this segment today. Dave is the executive producer on this podcast. We're going to talk about George Bailey Was Never Born. And also the person who's the, this is your podcast. This is your baby, right, Ray?
Yeah. I was the only one crazy enough to want to do a 10 episode podcast about the meaning of It's a Wonderful Life. Although,
well,
Cassidy and others were immediately extremely encouraging.
So tell me a little bit of the background. It's called George Bailey Was Never Born. Of course, this is one of the fundamental aspects of It's a Wonderful Life. What if George Bailey was never born? The whole concept behind that movie. And it's a concept that, as we find from listening to the podcast, really has taken off in the popular culture.
Yeah, like one thing that we noticed as we were thinking about how to approach a podcast about It's a Wonderful Life in kind of a creative way, not like kind of a standard podcast way, but how do we do something a little different here that comes from the DNA of the movie. You know, it occurred to us, we interviewed the three granddaughters of Philip Van Doren Stern, who wrote the original short story on which it's based in 1938. And inherent to the material right off the bat is the multiverse, which is now like so popular to the point of being almost uncool again in a very short amount of time. But and there's some science. It wasn't until the mid 50s I found out that science started to back the possibility that we all do actually live in a multiverse. But Philip was way ahead of the curve. And if you think about It's a Wonderful Life, it's the story of a guy who gets taken to a different part of the multiverse where he'd never been born. So we use that as a jumping off point. And we thought, because, you know, people who are a little more nerdy like to get super serious about their fiction and like to treat it almost as if they're talking about characters and events that really happen. And we thought, well, if we use this device, and the angel narrator from It's a Wonderful Life comes to us as the podcast narrator and essentially reveals that those events in Bedford Falls did happen. And so we're going to analyze those. But you know him only, you know, George Bailey and his friends from a beloved movie. So what does that mean? That means you live in one of the universes where George Bailey was never born. So it becomes a device where we can analyze our universe and maybe how different it is from the one we see in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't until I started listening to the podcast where it dawned on me that this really is a science fiction, almost a science fiction film, the story, anyway.
Yeah, and Philip Van Doren Stern was largely a nonfiction guy like Dave and I. And, you know, I think they still teach his Abraham Lincoln autobiography in schools and things. And he was very focused on the Civil War. He was strongly abolitionist and was very fascinated by the story of abolition. And but he always had, his family told us, he had this inkling that fantasy was this way that you could make audiences accept certain ideas that they wouldn't come into in the nonfiction realm. And he had a dream, we learned in 1938, this vivid dream that became this story that he outlined. That's essentially the brass tacks of what became It's a Wonderful Life. He was always fascinated by dreams and fantasy. So he wrote one of his first fantasy stories, and that became this huge phenomenon here.
So it was a short story, or I believe his daughter is even on the podcast, right?
So, well, yes, but she passed away. So he had one daughter, Marguerite. She went on to even bigger things than him. If you care about humanity, she was inspired by the success of the movie and the banking storyline to look into, she helped develop a thing called microbanking that's been alleged to have brought more than 100 million, some say 200 million out of poverty worldwide. You know, and I thought that was amazing that so much good was done as a direct connect jumping off of this movie.
But I had no idea. That's amazing. So talk a little bit about your own experience. And Dave, please, you too. I'm interested to know. I'll just mention It's a Wonderful Life. Like some of you, the people in the podcast, I have no idea the first time I saw it. I'm assuming it was in a repertory, you know, where I saw it, probably paired with some other Capra film, like, you know, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town or something like that. And I'm just assuming that's the case, maybe in the 80s or something like that. And then, of course, have had a copy on VHS for years. You know, you just wanted it around all the time in case you want to watch it. And it had a real impact on me. I just fell head over heels in love with Donna Reed. You know, just found this. And so it came as something, a surprise for me personally, also as a result of listening to some of the podcasts, that this was not an immediate hit. So that was also an interesting thing, that I just assumed it was a hit from the moment go. But that's my history with it. I've seen it since probably a good half dozen times.
Yeah, right. No, I know
I was going to ask you, Dave. I never heard your story when you first saw it, but
no, we grew up with the generation where we take it just for granted. It was always around us.
Yeah,
to the point of almost nausea. Parents were like, our fathers or mothers were like, we got to watch this together. The history of it is fascinating because it really only came into the popular culture and into the mainstream in the early parts of our lifetime, the three of us who are on this call. But I gotta say, you know, Ray talks about this project as if it was just like this obvious thing to do. When Ray first pitched this to me, I said, I'll help you, but I don't know who's gonna buy this. I was absolutely the Mr. Potter of the group. And I said, I'll help you. You find a pitch. And sure enough, I have to give a lot of credit to iHeartRadio for taking a stab. And they said, this is unlike anything that they'd seen a pitch for when they funded it. And they said, this is like a nerd's dream of a film class in podcast form. And I have to tell you, that's kind of what it is when it comes down to it. And there's something in this. What I like about it is the episodes that I had pegged from day one as being most interested in aren't necessarily the ones. I think the Potter, where we examine Potter. Is Potter the hero, the villain, etc.? What would the alternate universe and the other outcome be with Potter? That was the episode that I thought came out to me was the one that challenged me the most. But my dad, this is his favorite movie. He made me watch it as a little kid over and over again, and I hated it. It was this tedious sort of family tradition of dad making us all watch it around Christmas time. And then somewhere in my teens, it just clicked. Wow, this is amazing. I love this movie. And it was so interesting to kind of look back at how it started as this torturous thing that was being pushed upon me to all of a sudden being, man, I get why this is in the top five of the AFI's all-time greatest movies list, because it is it's a tremendous film, but it took a little bit of time. In the same way that it took the public time to accept this for being a great film and seeing success, it took me, and I think a lot of young people for that matter. You know, if you're 8 years old, this is going to be that movie. It's not in color. It's long. It takes a long time to get to the really good part is the last third. I understand why it took so long for me to come around and maybe for the public to come around. It's different. It's challenging. And you know what? That it's a broadly accepted classic is incredible to me.
Well, I wonder what it was then about the time when you were a teenager and you revisited it, what it was that you connected with since you brought it up.
No, that's really fair. I think it was just an understanding of truly the filmmaking and the story and just that. The depth of it. You know, Ray brought up a really interesting point that this was a multiverse sort of film. And you don't look at it that way.
No.
But it had so much more depth to it that I didn't realize, I think, as a kid. As a kid, I was struck as a kid in the 80s who was hung up on MTV and VH1 and all like those things that I enjoyed. I liked that something that was as slow and plodding. It was around my early teen years too, Adam, that I started getting really into like Sergio Leone films. Mm. I love a good 3-hour slow burn Western. And it was just that once tolerance of youth fading.
Once Upon a Time in the West, for instance. Mm.
Incredible, you know, incredible. It was just that development where you need to have a little patience, and patience comes with maturity, and then with maturity. But then I'm a big Mr. Smith Goes to Washington fan. That one just feels far more accessible. Yeah. But Jimmy Stewart, I don't know how else to put it. I'm just a huge believer in the talents of Jimmy Stewart. And at a certain point, you start understanding acting, and it's harder. Maybe you don't grasp it when you're 7, 8 years old, just what a great performance is. But then when you start kind of grasping what a person is doing and how they're achieving greatness before your eyes, you really start to understand it. You understand it as sports at a certain age, but acting, it took me a little more time to really grasp that in the art form.
Is it my imagination? I'm kind of remembering a colorized version of the film. So was it colorized for a while? When they first figured out that technology, they started colorizing everything, and then I think largely it was rejected. So,
and they did that. They did that in part. So I think Ted Turner led that, and right, that was right, so. Right.
That's right.
Because it had fallen in the public domain, anybody could use it. So if you were like a Ted Turner, you're like, well, how do I do a version that I can control, that I can sue somebody for using? They're like, I got it. We'll colorize it. I made the effort to color it. If you're watching the color version, somebody's got to pay me something. I think that's really the story there.
Wow. That's a cynical interpretation of events, but I kind of admire you for figuring that out. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. And I mean, look, this is a classic. Jimmy Stewart is timeless. All of the cast in this movie are amazing. And then you have, in the age of Trump, dare I use the T word, Mr. Potter. So, you know, he's still a great villain. He's still relevant as ever.
Yeah, and I've actively tried to avoid Trump throughout my career. I feel like the guy gets enough of our oxygen. But we set out with no agenda in this show, and we did about 150 interviews. Of course, we picked the interviewees, so that's an agenda. But really, the 10 episodes came out of themes that just kept emerging from these 150 conversations, and they started to seem to lump together into – you know, certain categories that became the episodes. And Trump couldn't be avoided, in particular the one that Dave mentioned, episode 3, Henry F. Potter, American Antihero, in part because, you know, we were lucky enough to have Jimmy Stewart's, one of his only two biological daughters, they were twins, Kelly Stewart Harcourt, talked with us. And in 2020, there was someone at the GOP convention, Natalie Harp, who gave an impassioned speech in which she compared Donald Trump to George Bailey. And so Kelly broke the family's longstanding rule about not mixing her dad's legacy with politics to write an open letter to the New York Times that she still calls her proudest publication, in which she refuted the values of Trumpism as being essentially the antithesis of what this movie and what George Bailey was about. So there were times we just couldn't avoid the big T.
Oh, yeah, with the big T and with the little T. Jimmy Stewart, I know, was a Republican. Wonder what he would make of the party these days. You know, I have to rethink the whole thing, you know, from the top down.
Yeah, friend of Reagan's. He was a good pal of Reagan's.
Yeah, but, right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, you know, another thing that struck me, and I think why I connected to it when I discovered it, is because, man, it really, it gets intense. You know, when I was watching this, I just thought, oh, it's a Hollywood feel-good movie. And at the end, it is just that. But you get to a point where he's desperate. Jimmy Stewart, as George Bailey, is desperate. He's about to jump off the bridge. And you believed he would do it. He was that desperate. So it's like, whoa, that's pretty amazing. It's a film dealing with suicide. I don't know. And prostitution.
Violet Bick. Yeah.
Pretty. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just, the dark side of, in the multiverse version, you know, the multiverse, the version of Life Without a George Bailey, it's pretty remarkable what we see and what happens to Bedford Falls.
That's another thing that emerged. Yeah, this idea of It's a Wonderful Life as a suicide prevention tool. It's one of the few movies that looks close at suicide because that's so hard to, you know, spend a movie watching. And I mean, among other things, by a weird coincidence, it became this endless trope. Almost every TV show has done a take on It's a Wonderful Life at some point. And we were like, well, what was the first? Yeah, it's so common. And you hear in episode one, just clip after clip after clip from like a who's who of TV shows. But we found out, all right, what was the first one? And it turns out it looks like among the earliest serious ones, 1979, Mork and Mindy does an episode. It's a Wonderful Mork. And of course, that's Robin Williams' vehicle. And was it 35 years later? He tragically ends up committing suicide. And the script writers for that episode were sort of unpacking how useful they felt the movie itself could be as something to counter the cynicism and hopelessness that's plaguing our times, especially for young people now. So, mm-hmm.
So how many people you mentioned did you interview?
Yeah, Dave, I don't know how many made it into ended up making it into the final. I think at some point I had counted 200 conversations, which is totally unnecessary.
Well, Ray always told me, because I think that the one thing that I always kept saying to Ray when I was getting rough cuts was, wow, these are really long. And he kept saying to me, well, I'm only going to get one shot to make this project, so I want to get it all in there. And that went through the entirety of the production process. 200 interviews, I mean, that would be a lot for any project whatsoever. I mean, probably the densest of biographies out there have fewer interviews than what Ray and Kurt put in on the production end of this. But it's a reflection of sometimes you only get one shot to do something and you just got to go for it. And they went for it.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Kurt. I definitely want to mention Kurt Engfer, who has had a whole great body of work in documentary, but he was perhaps best known as the editor producer of Michael Moore directed Bowling for Columbine and Fahrenheit 9/11. And he was our co-creator. He wanted to be here today, but such is the life in the documentary profession. He jumped immediately to the next production and is underwater on that right now.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that, and we'll miss him. The hell with him. No. I'm sorry, it couldn't be. And the name of the podcast, by the way, is George Bailey Was Never Born. It's a great, great idea. And currently, all 10 episodes of the first season, or maybe the only season, I don't know, are available right now. So were there any, I don't know if this is the right question to ask, but were there any interviews that you would have loved to have that you couldn't get?
Well, Dave and I worked hard on trying to work different angles to get certain celebrities, and we weren't necessarily trying for any celebrity. There were people who seemed to have expressed devotion to this movie or had certain connections. In fact, we became the first, you hear it in episode, no, it's episode one, that we became the first to go deeper into how the movie fell in the public domain. And long story short, we ended up learning that Rashida Jones, the great actor, her grandfather was the one in charge of legal at a place called NTA when somebody failed to renew that copyright. So every time you watch Parks and Rec, you see Rashida, just know that maybe your favorite movie reached you because of something her grandfather failed to do.
This would be her maternal grandfather.
Yes. So like Harold Lipton was in charge of legal at NTA by that point. His daughter, Peggy Lipton had already, like, I think, gotten an Emmy for her role in The Mod Squad, was already a big star. She marries Quincy Jones the same fall that it falls into the public domain, the same fall they have the little whoops. But then 2 years, you know, they already had Khadija Jones. And 2 years later, Rashida shows up. And we wanted Amy Poehler, her castmate in Parks and Rec, because Frank Capra's granddaughter, Hannah Ermey, felt that Parks and Rec and Leslie Knope was kind of the closest modern parallel in media to George Bailey. And she had played in an early parody, like a 1994 parody of It's a Wonderful Life called Escape from Wonderful Life, which got shelved by Viacom, we learned, because they had just managed to reacquire the movie back from public domain, which we go into how they pulled that off. And so they had just signed this great long-term TV deal with NBC, where most people have gotten used to seeing it once or twice a year. And they didn't want to put out this parody movie, so they shelved it. But if you listen to our podcast, you'll hear some of the funnier clips from that.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, I got to ask, and I think I chatted a little bit with Dave about this, and it's a kind of a sensitive subject, which is Frank Capra. He's a beloved Hollywood director. He's certainly proven himself as a very able filmmaker, having made some of the most successful, famous Hollywood films. I heard through a film historian who wrote a biography of him, and there was many attempts to sabotage this author's efforts because he got his access to the Frank Capra's personal files that were in a Wesleyan University. Once he was going to try to tell what actually happened with being called in private meetings with the committee that was exploring communism in Hollywood. So he apparently named names, from what I understand. And his own autobiography, which I have not completed, I have it, but I haven't read it. He paints a much nicer picture of his life, you know, coming from immigrant background and everything else, but that he left that part out, of course. So I don't know. I don't know if this is something that came up during your own investigations and your own work on the podcast, but I'm just wondering what your thoughts are.
Dave, what did you discuss on that off podcast?
Oh, no, we were just discussing, and I got to be honest, I hadn't connected it. You know, obviously there's a conversation about some of the writers, and some of the people that were in the writing room and actually winding up on the blacklist. But I hadn't arrived at anything definitive that was out of it. But Adam has an obvious concern about, rightfully so, you know, I mean, people that name names in Hollywood. There was some really significant damage done.
There's, you know, some evidence about it, but it was never something that was actually really explored publicly in any thorough way. When people talk about, you know, those who name names, they usually go to Elia Kazan. Frank Capra isn't usually brought up.
Yeah, Capra's such an interesting guy because he was a lifelong Republican. And for a lot of Franklin Roosevelt's administration, he was vocally anti-New Deal. And yet he had this tendency to use these far left screenwriters who would later be targeted by the McCarthy hearings.
Right.
Some of them had been communists. Well, one, at least one we know of had been an actual communist and for 6 months. And we do in episode 3, we sort of bring to life. We got to know this guy, John Noakes, who in the mid 90s, essentially the FBI responded to a FOIA request by accidentally providing things that hadn't been asked for and ended up releasing all these memos that revealed that the FBI, under J. Edgar Hoover's direction and with like his regular sign off, began in 1947 to monitor the movie It's a Wonderful Life while it was still playing in theaters. They thought it was subversive, and they turned for their criteria to an outside consultant who turned out to be Ayn Rand, who wrote the FBI's criteria for looking for communist subversion within film. And they thought that the the scene that a lot of people watch the movie every year and it gets them like almost jumping out of their seat is when George Bailey tells off Mr. Potter. And apparently it's quite the meme online. Do you know how long it takes a working man to save up $5,000? But they smelled commie right there in that scene. And and J. Edgar signed off on it being listed as subversive. But in the end, they were never able to bring any charges around all this surveillance of Wonderful Life writers. So what do you do with all this material? And they found a willing recipient in Joe McCarthy in the House Un-American Activities Committee. And they could, as you know, as many people know, could use it to smear and end careers. And we actually found out Walt Whitman Odets is the son of Clifford Odets. Now, Clifford is not credited in at the end of It's a Wonderful Life. You won't find his name anywhere. But we discovered that about the first act of the movie, many elements of it had come from a draft he did before Capra came on.
Wow. And, okay.
Well, I mean, another thing that we discovered mid-interview is he's describing – Walt Whitman Odets is describing his grandfather, who Clifford Odets would not – let him ever see or interact with because all he cared about was money. And he's describing this, his one interaction with his grandfather. And I say, this sounds exactly like you're describing Mr. Potter and Mr. Potter's office. And he goes, huh. And I go, you think maybe that, you know, that this was pulled from your grandfather? And he goes, well, I do now. But Clifford Odets, to finish the loop there, he actually talked with Elia Kazan. He had spent 6 months in the Communist Party, and if he did not name names, he was going to jail. His wife had just died, and he was raising two kids and he could not go to jail. So he talks with Elia Kazan, and Kazan tells him, look, I've already named these names. I've given them up. If you've got to name somebody, just name those people. So he does this, but of course, no one knows this, so he's vilified by the left from then on.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this was not uncommon. Sterling Hayden did the same thing. A number of people would name that was their sort of rationale. And look, it is a rationale. And if Frank Capra did that, again, it would have been in a kind of closed door meeting. It was not a public committee panel like we've seen with Elia Kazan and others. You know, this was agreed to that it would be done behind closed doors, from what I understand. But, you know, it's a technicality. You know, there are others that chose not to name names. They could have named names of people that were already named as well, and they chose not to. It's always been my
feeling. I don't want to dodge your direct question. It didn't come up in our research that he named names, and I'm aware of a couple of recent. No, and I know that there's a couple of recent biographies, and I know that there was a documentary that premiered at Venice that says this. And I'm not doubting those people that went and mined it. And in some ways, it's interesting because maybe it was a really well-kept secret. And he obviously kept it out of his autobiography because, you know, who's going to put that in her autobiography at that point anyway? And it is, you know, it's a complicated film and a complicated legacy, whether he did or he didn't. If he did, it's even more perplexing that you have a film that was absolutely investigated by the FBI as being subversive of banking and being of a communist ilk. And meanwhile, you have this background that he was a Republican. And you think about this as well in the context of today and the way we talk about, and I'm not getting into the blacklists and that's completely separate. But what I mean is like the way that we can have people of these different political backgrounds, and it can make a film that is almost confused as communist, right? And they're diehard Republican. And even into the day they died, they believed that this was a work that was just purely good and necessary and worthwhile. And it was the right message to put forth. Honestly, those guys couldn't make that movie today there would be such a strong division. And it's interesting to kind of think about the fact that we could have these arch Republicans make what might be one of the great liberal classics.
Yeah. And by the way, even if he was a name-namer, what have you, even if he didn't name, it doesn't take away from the film, nor is it really especially relevant to the film and what the podcast is covering. It's just, of course, you're taking in the entire, you know, Capra / It's a Wonderful Life universe or world. And so it's worth kind of bringing up anyway. It's an interesting story. It might have been, I mean, this was at least a few years before any of this would have happened anyway, right? The film came out in 40s.
December 1946 ran for about a year.
Okay. So Yeah, pretty close. But I think there was that first wave, and I don't think that's when this occurred. And then there was another wave in the 50s, right? So,
Yes, and Capra's career, everything that he's largely known for is everything he did up to It's a Wonderful Life, through Wonderful Life.
Right.
It took down his independent studio Liberty Films. He never really recovered psychologically, and he never made another movie that critics called one of his important films after Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
And he got to live into the early 80s when he saw it return. And I think the quote we use from him in the podcast is like, it's the damnedest thing I've ever seen. You know, I can look at it now as if I had nothing to do with this movie. It's like your kid grows up to be president, you know, I think was the quote. But he had always considered it. The other quote from him was, I thought it was the greatest film I ever made. I thought it was the greatest film anybody had ever made. So he was severely depressed and disappointed that that audiences did not catch on to what he thought was the best film ever made.
Yeah. Well, that's actually my favorite story in the whole podcast is the story about the New Yorker article that was written and that about a viewing party that happened every year. And then Capra read the New Yorker article and asked for an invite to the next year and actually came with his own personal print. Amazing. And told everyone stories. And the guy loved his movie. And you know what? I work with someone who watches every single movie that she's ever made, every time it's played, every time she's there. She loves her work, Barbara, you know, and Capra loved his work. And I respect that in a lot of ways. He just wanted his baby to be seen and seen the way that he saw it. And he was gratified.
There's the element of when you see it with a new audience, you're seeing it for the first time.
100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I loved it. I want to recommend this podcast to everybody. Thanks in part to iHeart Radio or podcast, iHeart Podcasts. It's called George Bailey Was Never Born. All 10 episodes of the season are available at the moment. We'll put, as if we need to put a link out there, but we'll share that information. And what's next, Ray? Do you have are you inspired to do something again similar?
Yeah, I'd love to, because this was totally outside what, you know, my body of work up till now has been, and it was a lot of fun. So I'd love to do more of it. But, I mean, Dave and I are cooking up a few things, including our first podcast with iHeart was called After the Uprising, and it looked at something completely different, which is, deaths of Black Lives Matter activists out of St. Louis and investigating what were alleged to be murders. And we got a season 2 that'll roll out over the summer next year. And it looks at one of the most famous Black activists of recent times, Darren Seals, and his 2016 homicide. And we may have solved it. I'm not sure yet, but it looks like possibly. So that'll be the next thing coming up from us.
Impressive.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
I don't see a lot of crossover audience, though, between...
Maybe not. Me? Maybe. You got one anyway here. I'm intrigued. Anyway, guys, really thank you for putting this on my radar and for Dave for, getting me involved and appreciate it.
Nah, we appreciate you, Adam, and the way you've always supported independent film and media, just like podcasts as well. And you were on my short list of people to reach out to when we started creating one. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. All right, guys. Well, have a great evening. And what can I say? This has been a real pleasure for me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. We'll be back, of course, next week with a brand new episode of the podcast. Until then, take care of yourself and the ones you love.